We are talking once again with Job Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, local writers and activists, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
All right. As we sometimes do at the top of the show, we mention important people's passing. And this week was another local icon who passed.
Yeah, Gene Darcy, who's worked on many, many different issues over the years, dedicated activist and a dedicated listener to this show, passed away yesterday. We don't have any details on how or why she died, but she was getting up there in years, so we will miss her a great deal. And this show's for her.
We were talking before the show that several of us hadn't seen too many
emails from her
for a while. So,
yeah.
All right.
And, she usually let us know when she didn't like something we said.
Yes.
Yes.
She would point out corrections or something.
She was very good about that.
Which weren't always correct in themselves, but that's okay.
But that's okay. Yeah.
So, a reminder to reach out to those you haven't heard from in a while and check in on them.
And check in on them and see how they're doing. Yeah.
Yep.
I had another announcement that just kind of came through my email inbox this morning is that the folks who were gathering signatures for I-135,
yes!
The Social Housing Initiative, announced that they have heard from the Seattle Ethics and Elections that they have enough signatures to get on the ballot. They're just not sure which ballot yet. They were hoping for a November ballot, but it may be that they have missed the cutoff for that, and it may be a February ballot. But the I-135 Social Housing Initiative will be on the ballot at some point. So that is good news.
That is exciting news.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably the only good news we got in the next 50-some minutes.
Yeah.
Spoiler alert.
It's not the only good news. There's a couple, at least one other item.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Maybe a couple.
I concur.
Yeah. All right. Well,
depends on whether you consider, Trump's search warrant to be good news.
Yeah.
Which I do. Right. Anyway, let's
skip past the clickbait and move on to the. the main course. All right. So starting out with natural gas pipelines.
Yeah. This week, Attorney General Bob Ferguson's office here in Washington State, along with the attorney generals of the states of California and Oregon, filed paperwork with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission to oppose the expansion of the GTN Express pipeline project. The pipeline, which runs from Canada through Idaho, Eastern Washington, and Oregon, to California, it carries fracked natural gas to California's pipeline system. TC Energy, the parent company of GTN, wants to spend about $335 million to expand capacity on the GTN pipeline and upgrade three compressor stations. One's located in Idaho, the second is located in Oregon, and the third is the Starbuck Compressor Station in Walla Walla County, Washington. TC Energy was the company behind the Keystone XL pipeline project, one of the companies. According to the Washington State Attorney General's office, the project would increase CO2 emissions in Washington by 3.47 million metric tons per year, which is the equivalent of adding about 754,000 gas-powered cars to the state's roads. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission has estimated that the pipeline expansion could increase greenhouse gas emissions by 16% in Idaho, 3.8% in Washington State, and 7.7% in Oregon. Often touted by the oil and gas industry as a clean transitional fuel, natural gas nevertheless produces methane emissions that are a much more potent greenhouse gas than CO2, even though it doesn't stay in the atmosphere quite as long. But Washington passed a law to require 100% renewable electricity generation by the year 2040. And Oregon has passed a similar law for 100% renewable energy by 2045. The GTN pipeline project is designed to carry an increased amount of natural gas to the Northwest in California for at least 30 years. That's what it says in the design plans. And that's at a time when all three states are trying to phase out natural gas. Washington State also now bans natural gas in new commercial buildings and is expected to eventually ban natural gas in new residential buildings, too. GTN claims that it needs to expand the pipeline's capacity because of increasing demands in the Pacific Northwest, not in California. But the pipeline currently supplies almost double the amount of gas that Washington and Oregon currently use together. So expanding it is entirely unnecessary. Demand for natural gas is already falling in California, and it's expected to begin falling soon in Washington and Oregon, too. But GTN is not the only supplier of natural gas to Oregon and Washington. So it looks like what they are really wanting to do is to expand their pipeline capacity so that they can steal market share from other suppliers, not because there's a need here for more natural gas. And they're currently negotiating and signing 30-year deals to supply natural gas to utilities here in Washington and in Oregon.
That would go to like 2050-something.
Yeah, exactly. So that's actually goes directly against the stated goals of both the governments of Oregon and Washington State, saying that they're trying to phase out natural gas use within our states by the year 2040 and 2045. Now, if the pipeline expansion is built, the GTN Express pipeline will be the second largest greenhouse gas emitter in Washington State, behind only the TransAlta Centralia power plant, which runs the state's only coal-fired power generator.
Wait, I thought that was being shut down too, right?
It is. It's slated for retirement in 2025, and that's just 3.5 years from now. Okay, that's the biggest greenhouse gas emitter in the state. So if the GTN Express pipeline expansion goes through, it will in 3.5 years be the biggest emitter of greenhouse gases in Washington State. So it's really good news that the three state attorney generals have filed a joint motion opposing the expansion plan with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. The pipeline project is also being opposed by several communities in Idaho, Washington, and Oregon, which are situated near the pipeline, and the environmental group Columbia Riverkeeper. Columbia Riverkeeper posts regular updates on the pipeline project on their website. So
yeah,
that would
be a good place to go. They do great work.
So that'd be a good place to go if you're interested in fighting the pipeline and want to read up more about it.
Well, at least Bob Ferguson has a pretty good track record when it comes to taking on large corporations.
He does.
Yeah, so. he tends to win.
Mm-hmm. Well, he's pretty selective on his choices, but
Yeah, in this case, well, they do have one thing. There is one thing kind of going against these state attorney generals, and it's that Congress just recently passed the big infrastructure bill, the Inflation Protection Act, and within that is embedded language that says for sales of leases on public lands for things like renewable energy, the federal government also has to sell leases for offshore oil and gas drilling. In addition, Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer had to commit to passing a bill in Congress that would simplify and speed up the process for these types of pipeline and other energy infrastructure projects. So that could affect this pipeline as well.
Thank you, Joe Manchin.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oiling the wheels of our destruction.
Mm-hmm. Yep, but at least he'll make money on his investments.
He'll be able to hang out in his yacht while the seas rise.
Yeah, in his oversized yacht.
Yeah.
With people like Elon Musk.
All right.
Although I think Elon Musk is planning to go to Mars, right?
And not a moment too soon.
Yeah. Well, if he doesn't go there, I'm sure we can do a GoFundMe to send him there.
Yeah.
So next up, gas-powered automobiles.
Yeah, the other good news this week, California first and then Washington State announced bans on gas-powered automobiles by 2035. And this week, the California Air Resources Board released a plan to ban the sale of gas-powered automobiles in the state by 2035. 35% of new cars sold in California must be zero emission by the year 2026. And that's just 4 years away. And 68%, or over two-thirds, have to be zero-emission vehicles by the year 2030, about 8 years away. On Wednesday, Washington State Governor Jay Inslee then followed suit and announced that our state will follow California's lead and ban the sale of gas-powered vehicles by 2035, although the details have not yet been finalized here on the Washington plan. The state's going to have to work out a plan, and then the public will have the ability to comment and ask for changes. Now, the Washington State Legislature passed a bill in 2020, Senate Bill 5811, which directs our State Department of Ecology to adopt new emission rules to match California's whenever they roll out a new one. That sparked Governor Inslee's announcement on Wednesday. The California rule applies to passenger cars, SUVs, vans, and light trucks, kind of like those delivery trucks that you see on the street, for example, FedEx, post office vehicles, UPS, small moving vans, things like that. Heavy trucks will have an additional 10 years to make the switch. So things like big semis. Now, the Washington State Legislature this year included language in the new transportation bill that sets a voluntary goal of phasing out the sale of new gas-powered vehicles by 2030. And that's 5 years ahead of California's new plan. But then that's kind of a high goal with no requirements involved. So there weren't any, you know, the language wasn't there saying that we are required to. It's just that's our goal. Right. Now, this new plan would put firm minimum requirements into place. So nice hard targets that we have to hit and requirements for vendors to reach and for automobile companies to reach as well. So the law here in Washington is not expected to ban the resale of used gas-powered automobiles. That's one part of the issue, right? So used cars will still be able to be sold here. And notably, the U.S.'s two largest car manufacturers are already making the shift to producing more electronic vehicles. So General Motors, for example, is expected to be ending the production of gas-powered cars by 2035. So they are expecting to be all sales of electric vehicles by that target date, 2035. And Ford has committed to spending $50 billion to produce electric vehicles by the year 2026. Now, they haven't committed to an end date for gas-powered vehicles yet. But hopefully now that California and as other states follow suit, just put these hard targets into place, hopefully Ford will also commit to that too. In the meantime, Washington State is trying to address one of the shortfalls of shifting to electric vehicles, the lack of charging stations. Washington is set to receive about $71 million from the new Inflation Reduction Act bill that Congress just passed. And that money can be used to build a string of electric charging stations along the state's major highways. And then this year, the state legislature here in Washington also included $69 million in the big transportation bill that was passed to build what are called, what they called community charging stations for people who live in group housing, like in apartment buildings, townhouses, and condos, and so forth. And then the city of Seattle is beginning to require new buildings to provide hookups for electric vehicle charging stations. They don't necessarily have to install the charging infrastructure, but they have to wire the building in such a way that it would be easy to purchase and install electric vehicle charging stations in the new buildings. Seattle City Light is currently installing curbside electric vehicle charging stations in neighborhoods throughout the city. So neighborhoods have been able to ask Seattle City Light to be added to the list of places where they install electric vehicle charging stations, literally on the street for anyone in the neighborhood to use. So transportation makes up the largest chunk of our state's greenhouse gas emissions at 40%, and it's literally the largest source of greenhouse gas emissions within the United States in total. About two-thirds of the vehicle emissions here in Washington are from the type of vehicles that will be banned under this new plan, so mostly, you know, single-passenger automobiles, SUVs, vans, and light trucks. Currently, about 20% of all new vehicles registered in Washington are either electric vehicles or they're electric hybrid vehicles, and about 8% are fully electric. So, and that's a big increase just in the last few years. Washington State Washington State is seeing like a growing share of electric vehicles and growing demand. Now, Washington State's not alone in following California's lead. The state of Oregon's Department of Environmental Quality also said this week that they are already working on a similar set of rules, and that California's announcement is helping them to bring into focus what their own rules should be. So clearly they're looking at California to set the tone, and they're going to try to follow it. Three other states so far have announced that they will also follow California's lead. New York, which has a large population, right? And Vermont. And 12 other states have committed to following California's emission laws. And those are Colorado, Connecticut, Delaware, Maine, Maryland, New Jersey, New Mexico, Nevada, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, Virginia, and the District of Columbia. So in total,
every one of those states voted for Biden.
In total, this would cover about one-third of all Americans by population. And the federal EPA then announced that it is working on a new federal rule that would apply to all states in the U.S., and they hope to release a draft next year. So I don't know how close the EPA rule will follow the California rule, but I'm kind of hoping it will. We'll see.
It's very good news.
Mm-hmm.
Typically at least a dozen states follow California's lead on setting emission standards. So, we're going to see more and more of those come online in the next couple weeks, I think.
Yeah. Right now there's rising demand for electric vehicles throughout the United States, but there's also a shortage in supply.
Sure. So I have a really ignorant question. What's the environmental cost of manufacturing those batteries? Because that's problem
what I,
too.
Yeah, that's kind of what I want to mention here too, that in terms of the shortage of supply of electric vehicles, some of that relates to a shortage of minerals like lithium and cobalt for batteries. And that shortage could slow down production and slow down the timeline considerably. So I think it's really important that we consider other things that we can do as well, like car sharing, renting a car when you need one, if you don't need to use one every day, rather than owning a car.
Public transit
whenever you possibly can. And of course, renovating and adapting existing automobiles so that all EVs don't have to be manufactured from scratch. We should also be looking at other technologies. There are other other fuel types that could be burned in an engine besides just gasoline that we could be utilizing as well. And I think it's also important to consider whether or not you actually need to own a car, you know, and if in your family you need to have two or three or four cars, because many American families do have not just one car. They have two cars, one for each parent in the family. They may have a third for their kids to share, or they may have a spare pickup truck, you know, or a spare SUV or a spare van, you know, and the vehicles multiply. I think it's worth considering what's the minimum that you absolutely need to have versus what's the maximum that you have for convenience sake, and a spare and another spare.
Yeah, and getting vehicles off the road in and of itself saves emissions.
Yeah. Of course, there's nothing to stop people living within Washington, Oregon, or California from eventually going outside those states to buy new gas-powered cars and then bringing them back into the state, except for a federal ban on gas-powered cars, if one can be implemented without conservative states trying to stop it in federal court. And I guess we'll see next year when the EPA releases its draft rule. In the meantime, these new rules here in Washington will rely on people's willingness to adopt a new technology that will be cleaner, quieter, and better for the environment, but also a real pleasure to drive. I mean, I have to say that having driven both an electric vehicle and an electronic hybrid, an electric hybrid car, that they were both a real pleasure to drive. I have to say that. I love the fact that they were a lot quieter. I could actually hear elements of the car versus just the engine. One of the things I really, really loved was...
If the rest of the car is making noises, that's usually not a good sign.
Well, that's the thing, is I'm very sensitive to that kind of thing. So I liked hearing that I wasn't hearing knocks and things like that. Or hearing or feeling problems with the steering or anything like that. I'm really sensitive to that. I guess maybe it was the way I was raised. My dad on the farm used to say, "Hey, you know, I drive that car every day. If you're driving it, you notice something weird, let me know." So I really have to say I love driving the electric hybrid vehicle in particular, because it was designed in a way that when you stepped on the gas pedal, it drew from the battery. But when you step on the brake, it charged the battery. The friction of braking on the car charged the battery up. And it had this little indicator light on the dashboard where you could see when you were pulling from the battery, the indicator light would go red. And when you were charging the battery, it would go green. And then it had a separate little gauge that showed you what your battery charge was. And I would, every time I would drive one of those electric hybrid vehicles, I'd get in and I'd look at what the battery charge was, and I'd say, okay, my goal is to get the battery charged up higher than when I got into the car. So it was a little bit like playing a video game, you know, getting momentum to go up the hill without having to step on the gas pedal, get over the hill, and then do some gentle braking on the downslope to charge the battery. So it made it a lot of fun to drive, actually.
Probably not so much fun for the person driving behind you.
Oh, well, get used to it. Keeps you from speeding if you're charging your battery, right?
Yeah, I could definitely see a reasonable future where there was like one or two potential vehicles per block, or, you know, something to that equivalent for people to use, rather than like everybody needing one or two automobiles or vehicles, you know, planted in front of their house or in their driveway.
Yeah, if you think about all the money, all the time and money that you put into maintaining a car, and you think about the amount of time you actually use it, and all the time that automobiles sit idle, it kind of makes you wonder why everybody on your block has one or two or three or four, rather than just one for every two houses or every three houses. Mm-hmm. You know, that's why I say car share has got to be a thing that we all try to move towards in the future. Yeah. That and just the fact that there are so many people in the world now and our streets are limited in terms of the capacity for vehicles, there just has to be a point at which we say some of us don't need to be driving all the time.
Yeah. And American car culture is a huge problem too, because really more than any other country, you know, people, not always guys, but often, you know, get our personal identity from their cars, which has just never made any sense to me. But that really needs to stop. Cars and guns.
Yeah, and you know, there's something to be said ecologically just for people living closer together and kind of gathering within urban or semi-urban areas and leaving a lot more space for not just food production, but wild lands. Mm-hmm. I think that's really important too.
All right. And I just want to note that this is the first week in, what is it, like 2.5 years that Jav didn't go for a update on the pandemic. This is, I feel like we should have special music or something.
Yeah, well, the thing is, it continues, but there wasn't anything really new this week. But don't stop taking precautions. It'll probably be back next week, you know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Sorry, Maria, you were going to say?
Oh, I just was thinking on a personal level, you know, I'm continuing to be very careful to wear a mask when I'm in public with people that I don't know. And I'm kind of setting the goal for when I can get my booster shot that gives me protection against the most current variants. And the latest data that I saw is that it'll be about a month.
Yeah,
maybe
that's
a
correct.
Month and a half, and those should be starting to become available.
They're aiming for the end of September still, so we'll see.
So about a month.
Yeah, Pfizer has shared test results with the FDA so far, so we'll see.
Right. In the meantime, while you're waiting for that, it's a good idea to go out and get your flu shot. Flu shots are now available, as they usually are, at the end of August. So get your flu shot now. Get your 2 weeks of good sleep and rest and boosting your immune system, and you'll be then ready to get your COVID booster.
Okay.
Yeah, do as we say, not as we do, because neither of us got much sleep last night. So, but anyway.
All right. Moving on, developments this week with our former president.
Yes. Let's see. Thomas Jefferson is still dead. that former president. Yeah. The big news yesterday was a judge authorized a release of a redacted version of the affidavit used by the Department of Justice to justify their search warrant in Mar-a-Lago. Of course, Republicans had been baying for this for weeks, and as soon as it was released, they fell very, very silent for some reason. I can explain why. It is really damning. It's 38 pages. It traces the 20-month process of the National Archives trying to retrieve these documents from the former president. The documents that Trump had, there were 184 documents that have been seized overall. Of those, 50-some were classified. 92 considered secret, and then 23 were considered top secret. So those are the ones that you have to you can't even take them with you. You have to read them and read only in a skiff, a secure location. The big question that has not been answered. Actually, there are two big questions that have not been answered. One is that the search warrant and the affidavit did not name Trump per se. They specified his residence as where they would find these things. And but we don't know if the laws that were broken here were broken by Trump, by people on his staff, all of the above. It seems very likely that Trump is the target of this investigation, but we don't know that for sure. And then the other question is, why? You know, why was he resisting giving these documents back? It's surely it wasn't just ego. Was there a financial reward involved? Was he using it as potential blackmail against future charges? I mean, you know, the mind reels because he's totally amoral. So any possibilities are out there. I mean, you know, he could, and of course the other question is,
you want to know what I think? You want to know what I think the reason was? I think he was hanging on to them because psychologically he wanted to hang on to power. And so he wanted mementos of when he was in office to remind him of the power he had.
Well, and, you know, he probably still believes at some level that he's president, honestly. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, if it's a question of changing to a new president or changing the location of the White House, he's more inclined to change the location of the White House.
Yeah, to Mar-a-Lago.
Yeah, exactly. Permanently, I might add.
And I laugh, but I actually think that's what he thought.
Yeah, quite possibly. But, you know, I mean, it's a modern resort. I'm quite sure it has a photocopier or a scanner there. And so who knows where these documents were shared, whether, you know, in exchange for a few million dollars into an offshore bank account or, say, Jared Kushner's investment firm, whether Saudi Arabia or Russia, they would pay good money for information like this. And it's the type of information that was specified and that is truly alarming. We got human intelligence in the intelligence community. That is to say, the actual spies on the ground in foreign countries. That's the sort of information that can get people killed. Signal intelligence. So, you know, our ability to intercept, say, phone signals from foreign leaders. Who the witnesses were inside Mar-a-Lago who ratted Trump out. And of course, Trump is desperately trying to find out who that was now. Lists of foreign agents from hostile foreign countries that are in the United States. U.S. military troop movements were included in the documents here. I mean, this is the crown jewels of intelligence documents. Intelligence sources, particularly in foreign countries. So, for instance, you may remember in the run-up to the Russia's invasion of the Ukraine, where the United States issued warnings preemptively that Russia was going to do such and such, and then Russia had to change its plans. That happened several times. That's intelligence sources. And Russia would love to know who those intelligence sources are, I'm sure. So, you know, this kind of information is what Trump hung on to. And that's not an accident. That's not just casual mementos of his time in office. It's very, very alarming, and it really underscores that for a variety of reasons, Donald Trump is right now the single greatest threat to national security of the United States. And it's not even close. So another sort of undercovered aspect of this release yesterday is it really makes cooperation with, for instance, NATO allies or other allies of the United States whose intelligence agencies routinely share information. So if you're, say, Britain or France or Germany, are you going to share information with the United States now, knowing that, number one, Donald Trump could he doesn't have access to information since he left office, but he does have the information from before he left office, and he could be back in office. So are you going to trust that? Probably not. So I think this really undercuts the ability of the United States to share information with allies in terms of intelligence. And then Trump himself early this week did something that he had done previously during the Mueller investigation, which was asking for a special master to be appointed by a court to review the documents rather than the DOJ. That's basically being laughed out of court. And then it also emerged this week that in June, Trump's attorneys told the National Archives that all the items had been returned. Well, the National Archives knew that this wasn't the case, particularly because a lot of these documents are numbered sequentially and there were missing numbers. So they knew which documents were missing and how many of them there were. And that was reflected in the affidavit as well. So, and they had surveillance tape from Mar-a-Lago that showed that about the time, the National Archives had made a further request. And then, in response to that, the attorneys had said, nope, all gone. There were, boxes being removed from, the area where they had been stored and then scattered at quote multiple locations around the estate. So these weren't even locked away in a secure location. These were just there for any guest to access. And we know because there have been a number of incidents already. And there was another one that was, publicized this week of, foreign intelligence agencies or, in this case, it was just apparently a Ukrainian-born scam artist, penetrate Mar-a-Lago security and just wander around the premises. So we know that, for instance, China and Russia have targeted Mar-a-Lago for years because it's not very secure. And, this is where, you know, the nation's most secret documents were just kind of strewn around. Which underscores that Trump is not only venal, he's also incompetent. And it's an unfortunate combination. I suppose it could be worse. He could be competent, but, it's still really bad.
God. Yeah. Looking forward to, a future president with, his moral values and, extremely competent to boot.
Yeah, like DeSantis, for example.
Yeah. You know, I also noticed a little report about Donald Trump's social media site. I'm not going to say the name of the social media site because I don't want to drive traffic there. But apparently when he was kicked off Twitter, he started his own sort of Twitter knockoff social media site. And apparently that site now is having financial troubles like so many other Trump businesses that it's possible it will have to declare bankruptcy like so many other Trump businesses.
And people are now doubting that the initial capitalization was supposedly $1 billion. That does not look to have been true. Of course, it's shocking, absolutely shocking that Trump would lie about something like that.
Right, right.
But yeah, they're suddenly cash poor, which means either they spent an enormous amount of money and it doesn't really cost that much money to set up a social media site.
Apparently they haven't been paying anybody and, they're more than $1 million in debt.
The hosting company is threatening to sue because they haven't been paid since March.
Yeah.
Which,
was set up.
Yes, you would think that would be the first people that you would pay, right?
Yeah.
But apparently not, because Donald Trump doesn't pay anybody.
Right.
If you're a vendor and you're going to sell something to Trump, why at this point would you not ask for the money up front before you provide any services?
Yeah.
Because he's not going to pay you. He just won't.
All right.
I'll dare you to sue him.
Moving on. Lots of coverage this week about student loans.
Yeah. one of Joe Biden's campaign promises was to forgive student debt, and it's taken a year and a half. But he announced this week that the federal government will forgive $10,000 of federal student loan debt for anyone who makes less than $125,000 per year or $250,000 for a married couple. In addition, Pell Grant recipients can get an extra $10,000 in federal loans forgiven. Federal Pell Grants go to students from low-income families, and those folks usually have a more difficult time paying off student loans once they've graduated or left school. Biden also extended the freeze on federal student loan repayments, which was first instituted in March 2020 at the start of the pandemic and was set to expire at the end of this month. It will now expire at the end of December instead. Now, according to the Education Data Initiative here in Washington State, there are 788,500 people with student loan debt. That's about 10.2% of our state population. They owe an average of $35,510 each. Slightly less than half of them are under age 35, which I think really shows you what a long-term burden high student loan debt can be. If you've reached the age of 35 and you still owe debt that you accrued up to about age 23 or 24, right? Mm-hmm. 10 years later, you still have a ton of student loan debt. That's crazy, right?
Yeah. And a lot of that is interest at that point.
Yeah. And nationwide, about 43 million people are expected to benefit from this plan. And over 90% are expected to be folks who make less than $75,000 per year. Among those 43 million, about 20 million of them could have their entire debt erased under this plan. And that's pretty amazing. In addition, Biden proposed creating a new income-based repayment plan for federal student debt that would lower most monthly payments for people who won't have their entire debt erased. Payments would be capped at 5% of your monthly income instead of the current 10%, making it a lot easier for people to make their payments. And it would forgive debt balances after 10 years instead of the current 20 years. So then you wouldn't be 40 years old and still owing money on your student loan debt. Okay. Now, of course, Republicans complained about the quote unquote moral hazard of forgiving student debt. Like there's any moral hazard, right? They said dumb things like, you know, taxpayers will pick up the tab, right? As if there's something wrong with taxpayers investing in free education versus providing subsidies for oil and gas companies, for example.
Well, yes, because they oppose education because it's it's politically not advantageous for them.
Yeah,
they have an educated populace.
And of course, the response to that is there's a very strong argument to be made for free public education, not just K through 12 plus 4, but free education throughout a person's lifetime, so that you can do job retraining as the job market shifts, for example. Okay, there are very few other investments that public tax dollars can make that return such a high dividend for the overall well-being of your society than something like free public education.
And at this point, Republicans are trying to undermine K through 12 as well.
Yeah, it's crazy.
It really is. Let's go burn some books.
Let's not do that.
No.
All right. Anything else on that?
Nope.
Okay. Let's touch on the different police accountability news.
There was a bunch of stuff that came out this week. A former police detective in Louisville admitted on Tuesday that she had helped mislead a judge into wrongly authorizing the search warrant that resulted in the no-knock raid on Breonna Taylor's apartment in Louisville in March 2020. That, of course, resulted in Taylor's death as she lay sleeping in her bed. This confirmed something that had already been publicly reported, which was that the judge had been misled. Now we know who did it. The police were in fact looking for a former boyfriend of Taylor's who did not live at the address, and the detective had vouched that he was receiving parcels at that address. He had talked to a postal inspector who confirmed it. She admitted that she made up the whole conversation with the postal inspector. There was no such conversation. There was no such testimony. There was no such evidence. But Taylor died because of it. So she is pleading guilty to federal charges, three other Louisville former officers are also being charged by the feds in conjunction with that case. So we had a Florida sheriff's deputy who resigned after he pulled a gun on a pregnant black woman during a traffic stop outside Jacksonville last month. We know about this because her three children were in the back seat. One of them recorded the interaction where he was he literally pulled a gun on her because she hadn't pulled over immediately because it was nighttime and she didn't want to pull over on a deserted road, which is fairly reasonable, but he was very, very angry and, shall we say, acted unprofessionally. More than 2 years after Rayshard Brooks, which people may remember, he was one of the deaths during the summer of 2020 protests, a 27-year-old black man in Atlanta who was shot fleeing from police in the parking lot of a fast food restaurant. He was shot in the back, and the local attorney general in Atlanta, prosecutor, determined that the officer who fired, as well as another officer on the scene, committed no crimes in the incident. So that was the piece of bad news this week. But some accountability in Louisville and in Florida. So two steps forward, one step back.
All right. Moving on to severe wildfires.
Yeah, a new study in the journal Scientific Reports found this week that the extreme Australian wildfire season of 2019 to 2020 blew smoke 20 miles into the sky, similar to a nuclear blast. Okay, dark smoke particles reached the stratosphere and caused warming of 5.4 degrees Fahrenheit around Australia and 1.2 degrees globally for months afterwards in 2020. This was the highest temperature in the stratosphere since the eruption of Mount Pinatubo in 1991. Smoke particles in the stratosphere also underwent chemical reactions that eroded the ozone layer and caused a large ozone hole to open up over most of Antarctica in 2020. The ozone hole in Antarctica tends to open up in the spring and then close up again over the course of the summer. But 2020's ozone hole was the largest and longest lasting hole to open up in decades. Severe wildfires can produce massive clouds called pyrocumulonimbus events that can create their own weather patterns, including thunder, lightning, and high winds. Pyrocumulonimbus events also can spew ash tens of thousands of feet into the air, well into the stratosphere. So,
yes,
for example,
and we've seen that in some of the California wildfires too.
Yeah, for example, the McKinney Fire in the Klamath National Forest in Northern California this summer produced at least four such events in late July and early August, which produced a 50,000-foot plume of smoke that could be seen from outer space. Okay, unlike clouds, normal clouds, which contain water vapor and which tend to cool the earth beneath them, smoke plumes contain dark smoke particles that absorb heat and cause more warming. When they reach the stratosphere, which is above where airplanes fly, they can also damage the ozone layer. These large wildfire events are becoming more common, and scientists are becoming more alarmed because this is happening about 20 years earlier than climate scientists had predicted. They hadn't predicted these types of regular severe wildfire events to start happening until at least 2040, if not later, according to their climate change models. Those models may now be too optimistic. And they probably did not foresee the extensive damage to the ozone layer that these events can cause. Now, the ozone layer protects us from ultraviolet radiation. Ultraviolet radiation can cause skin cancer, eye cataracts, and weakened immune systems in humans, and it can negatively affect crop production, marine wildlife, sensitive ecosystems, and animal life on planet Earth. Climate change is affecting the ozone layer in other ways too. Ozone circulates up in the stratosphere, similar to the way clouds circulate in weather patterns in the lower atmosphere. In a phenomenon called the Brewer-Dobson circulation, air currents push ozone from the tropics towards the poles. Scientists have observed that this circulation is speeding up in recent years because of climate change, just as some weather systems are becoming more severe and also in some cases speeding up. The speed up of the Brewer-Dobson circulation appears to be contributing to a pattern of thinning ozone in the tropics. So as ozone holes open up in the polar regions, like in Antarctica, you know, more ozone is drawn from the tropics at a faster rate to fill up the area over Antarctica. To close up the ozone hole over Antarctica, it's leading to more thinning in the tropics. And unlike in Antarctica, which is very sparsely populated, the tropics themselves hold about half of the human population on Earth, as well as some very, very sensitive ecosystems. So that's a troubling development, and scientists are not sure yet how much thinning is actually occurring in the tropics, whether it's year-round or just seasonal, and whether the speed-up of the Brewer-Dobson circulation is something we should be more concerned about, whether these more frequent severe wildfire events could ultimately be causing some of that thinning or could be part of what's causing the Brewer-Dobson circulation to speed up. Scientists are really unclear about a lot of that. And a lot of this is sort of the brave new world of science observation in terms of this uncontrolled experiment we're doing with the planet Earth, namely climate change.
And, you know, we have about 30 or 35 years of experience now with the worst case scenario of climate change model turning out to be too conservative. It always goes in that direction.
Seems to be going in that direction, yeah. There are these feedback loops and unknown things that we didn't know about that are happening, and this effect on the ozone layer is one of those unknown things that we didn't really know would happen, and it's something to be very, very concerned about. So when people kind of poo-poo climate change and say, oh, we'll adapt, there's certain things that are very, very difficult to adapt to. One of those is the loss of the ozone layer.
Yeah, and it really underscores how little we understand about the planet we're despoiling, and how incredibly complex the biosphere is that allows for life on Earth and our life by extension. It's a very fragile thing, and
a very complex system. And when you push something too far to one side, it has effects that. You just are not necessarily going to be able to anticipate.
No.
Yeah. We broke the planet, and this is why we can't have nice things.
Well, the planet has some resilience, so it's not broken yet. And I think this is another wake-up call saying, okay, it's time to make a change here. We need to help things go back to a more congenial environment for not just human life, but all life on planet Earth.
Yeah, the planet will survive. It's a question of whether the life on it will survive.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, when I say planet, I generally include the life on the planet. So, all right. Let's move on to a nuclear reactor in the Ukraine.
Yeah, the largest nuclear reactor in Europe. It's at Zaporizhia. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Zaporizhia.
Well, yeah, okay.
have to drag out that J sound.
Right. that has been the subject of fierce fighting for several weeks now, and a lot of alarm around the IAEA and other nuclear experts, because the plant is being kept running only by a skeleton crew of Ukrainians who is being forced to work there by the Russian army. Russia has occupied the plant and its grounds since March. Ukraine is now trying to take it back. There's been a lot of fighting in the immediate area, so of course a lot of concern about the potential for fires at the reactor. And then Russia has announced its desire to take the plant off the Ukrainian power grid and transfer it to the Russian power grid. Now, this would involve taking it offline for a period of time and then restarting it. That is a complicated process that probably cannot be done by the crew that is on site there. And the question then arises, okay, how does Russia propose to do this? Because for sure the Russian army does not have that kind of expertise. And so Russia has agreed to allow the IAEA to come in and inspect the conditions at the plant. And I believe that's going to happen in the next week or so. So it's a little bit out of the news right now. But keep an eye on that plant, because that really is a linchpin right now. Not only does it supply about 20% of Ukraine's energy, but it's also located right in the center of the country on the Dnieper River. So it's a key location as well. Ukraine has been steadily trying to take back some of the Russian-occupied ports on the Black Sea. That also is big news, because it might mean that Ukraine has a better chance of blocking the blockade of export of grain that is causing food shortages in some parts of the world, particularly sub-Saharan Africa. So Kherson, the city of Kherson, at the mouth of the Dnieper River, that is being battled for by Ukrainians. Meanwhile, Russia has been trying to set the stage for an all-out attack on the major port city of Odessa. That is the third largest city in Ukraine. It's on the Black Sea, and it's a major port in that part of the world. And that's been blockaded, of course, for months. So a lot going on in Ukraine. We just marked the sixth anniversary of that invasion, and it looks like it's going to drag on for a good deal more time.
The six-month anniversary?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, they invaded in late February, so.
Yeah, I was just correcting that the sixth anniversary. Some would think would be 6-year anniversary.
Oh, sorry. I thought I said month. Okay. Never mind.
And finally, and just really quickly, you got 2 minutes, major droughts around the world, but, the Horn of Africa.
Yeah. The UN is warning that 22 million people are at risk of starvation in, what has been a 4-year drought now in the Horn of Africa. That's Kenya, Somalia, and Ethiopia. Of course, that part of the world has seen droughts and famine before, but this is the immediate crises in that part of the world. And you know, things like the loss of grain exports from Ukraine are not helping, particularly since that part of the world tends to have a very grain-based diet. And the crops are failing. It doesn't help that Somalia does not have a functional government and has not had for a couple of decades now. And Ethiopia is in the middle of a civil war, and there's terrorism and related violence in Kenya as well. They had a disputed election a couple of years ago, and that has had a lot of aftershocks. So, you know, we don't hear a lot about sub-Saharan Africa in our American media, even though a big chunk of the world's population lives there. But keep an eye on that part of the world.
As well as U.S. military operations that take place there that hardly ever make the news.
That is true, too.
All right. Well, on that happy note, we are out of time for this week.
Hey, we did have a couple pieces of good news this week, so you know
we did.
We hit them in there.
We're above our quota for the year.
We are, so it's probably going to be pretty bleak from here on out.
Yeah. Merry Christmas.
In August.
Yes.